demise of Silicon Valley has been predicted for decades, basically since it sprouted up in the 70s. A new book chronicles what has changed and what is the same as Silicon Valley continues to be the engine of the economy and of change. This week, Techonomics host Jason Middleton interviews Stanford University's Silicon Valley historian about her new book, and that starts now.
Hello and welcome, and thanks for listening as always. Now, this first segment is something we've never done before. It's kind of a triple play. There's a new book titled Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age. It's by Leslie Berlin, and our interview went way longer than anticipated, and that's solely because of the quality of the stories she was telling. So we lifted two smaller portions of that interview for this broadcast segment. First up is a table setter on what Silicon Valley was like culturally and idealistically in the 70s and early 80s.
When you're pushing the envelope, which everyone in this book is doing, it seems like trouble to the people around you. It's much easier to just keep doing things the way you've always done them.
The entire interview is already available online. It's at kgoradio.com/techonomics. And the full extended interview is on Stitcher and Audio Boom. And the triple here is that we will broadcast the entire show after the turn of the year. Here's part one of my chat with the author of Troublemakers.
My name is Leslie Berlin, and I am the historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford.
And you have a new book, Troublemakers, the subtitle being Silicon Valley's Coming of Age. What's the premise of Troublemakers, you know, kind of like your lead, your nut graph?
So the premise of the book is that there was this remarkable period of time between 1969 and 1976 where essentially the foundations for our modern lives and our technology today were all laid. The way I think of it is it's like the Beatles in that, you know, you have the Beatles in 1963.
Right.
They are doing Little Richard covers. 7 years later, they've completely transformed not just music, but everything around them. Mm-hmm. And Silicon Valley's the same way. This book starts, and it's just a place where gearhead engineers sell to other gearhead engineers. It's basically all about chips. 7 years later, we've got the personal computer industry, the video game industry, the biotech industry, modern venture capital's taking off. The first ARPANET transmission, which becomes the internet, is coming up. You've got the first time that Silicon Valley is really sending people to Washington, D.C. to try to kind of bring the valley into the minds of the government.
Right.
It's this incredibly fertile time. Oh, and at the same time, this is when the celebrity entrepreneur is born.
That's right. That's right. And speaking of fertile time, the cover picture, what year was that cover picture taken?
You know, I have to tell you, the cover is a total mystery to me. I don't know where they found it. I have been playing a game trying to figure out where is this picture
right.
taken.
I was guessing Cupertino from like the early 80s.
I could see that for sure. Yeah. I mean, it looks
it's very verdant, right? It's,
yeah.
it's covered in trees and greenery.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the valley before it was called Silicon Valley was called the Valley of the Heart's Delight. And it was one of the leading centers for fruits, for like plums and peaches
right.
and almonds and this sort of thing.
Right.
Now it is what it is. And in between, people don't really know this, it was a manufacturing region. There were factories here. People were actually building these things, the computers and the chips, sophisticated phone systems, disk drives. This stuff was all being built here. There were women working in factories in Silicon Valley, earning very good money, very solid middle class jobs.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into the major players of the period and everything, but I have a real quick follow-up.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, you called it Troublemakers, and I'm wondering, why not just Makers or Makers and Failures?
These were people who knew what they wanted to do, but they had to act outside almost of the structures that already existed. So if you look at any of these people, but let's take the guy who convinces Stanford to start licensing and patenting the ideas that come out of its students and faculty innovations and staff. This is how Stanford had a stake in Google.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that guy didn't, his name is Niels Reimers. He didn't set out to be a troublemaker, but the system just wasn't there for him to do what he needed to get done. So, yeah, he had to be a bit of a gadfly. This is a story again and again and again. When you're pushing the envelope, which everyone in this book is doing, it seems like trouble to the people around you. It's much easier to just keep doing things the way you've always done them.
That was Leslie Berlin, author of Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age. It was an excerpt Our interview went way longer than planned, but we wanted to get something on the air with quickness. The entire interview about the book and the history of Silicon Valley, trying to always pay it forward, it's online at Stitcher, Audio Boom, and KGORadio.com. Next up is the second excerpt. This one is more contemporary history. Leslie, let me ask you one more thing about innovation in the Valley, right? I mean, that's what we're about, right? Innovation, the zeitgeist of innovation and, you know, disrupt and move forward. How come Silicon Valley seems to be not so prized for that these days?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I would say that since the election, the perspective on the Valley from the outside has completely changed. I mean, it had always been that Silicon Valley was sort of our best hope for American economic success and sort of like, you know, the star pupil that you would trot out. And now Silicon Valley's under all sorts of threats and accusations for everything from, you know, fake news and sexual harassment. And is it too big? Is it leaning too far left? Are the Russians hacking it? What's happening to our private data? All of this has come up, and it really speaks to how important the Valley is to our daily lives now. I mean, our connection to the technology that comes out of this place is so intimate that it's hard to understand anymore, and would have been completely impossible for the people in the 70s to imagine that people would be carrying computers around on their wrists. I mean, you know, like we have the Dick Tracy watch, you know. Right. But the thing that has really struck me in these conversations is that throughout Silicon Valley's history, we've had this trend of people coming up with innovations for sometimes actually even personal reasons, but certainly not all of the ideas coming out of Silicon Valley have been developed for the sort of idea of we're going to radically change the world. Mm-hmm. And they are these ideas that start small and grow so big, so fast, kind of outrunning the original intent of the people who started them. And I mean, you saw this with the whole microchip industry starts because there are eight guys who can't stand their boss and they start their own company. And literally a decade later, they are on the floor of Congress making a completely credible argument that the American economy and national security are at risk if we don't come up with a way to protect the American chip industry.
Well, Facebook, 10 years after launch, is on the floor of Congress saying that, whoops, maybe we didn't handle the fake news as well as we could. So don't we bring some of this down on ourselves? Why? I guess I'm asking why this wave of, frankly, mature companies that we have stood up, why is Google still fighting these battles? They should know better by now. Did they learn nothing from the past?
Well, it's interesting. I really think, I mean, no one wants to hear this, and I am definitely a huge proponent of we need to explain what the guardrails need to be to these companies. I also think that we really have to take a hard look in the mirror and say, what have we been willing to do as consumers in terms of just giving our data away?
Well, that's true. I mean, this is a legendary thing that all of us as consumers looked over. If you're not paying for it, you're the product. Nobody really explained what that really means.
Yeah,
because that has a long tail.
I have a personal belief now that what we need to do is turn those terms of agreement that everyone just scrolls past and clicks. We need to impose something like was imposed on the credit card companies, where now there's just like the little box that says, look, if you pay the minimum amount, you are going to be paying 3x what the bottom line bill of this is. Mm-hmm. I would love to see a super easy to understand statement that essentially says, we're going to take this data, we're going to use it in the following ways, and you are giving us the right to do that forever in in every possible format. And then we could be making a more informed decision. And the other thing that really has to happen is that we have to get more transparency into what exactly is being fed into these neural networks and AI machines that are making it, you know, these systems that are making it so that we are becoming just data points that can be processed and sold to.
And then predictive analysis can also let advertisers, marketers, and other platforms know what we may be thinking 5 minutes from now.
Well, and not just them. Because I mean, there's been some very clear research showing that things like putting on the bottom of a notification, not just go out and vote today, but these of your friends have voted today and including their pictures. They did this in the, I think, 2016 election. Maybe it was earlier than that. It turned out an additional 300,000 voters just by this tiny little tweak in the algorithm. So it's the implications are much, much, much bigger than simply that annoying pair of boots that follows you around on the web.
I think these regulation drafts that you've just come up with are completely viable and need to be discussed at length. Maybe I'll have you back, as I've had some of these discussions with Scott Galloway, with Vivek Wadhwa, with Kevin Kelly. We've had these discussions not just around AI, of course, but like you said earlier, our data. Kevin says we should opt in and sell our data, be paid for our data collection and activity, whereas Scott might say something almost to the opposite end of that.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that the unifying thread there is that we should be in control of this. And that, I think, absolutely is correct.
Leslie Berlin, this has been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for braving the traffic and for writing Troublemakers.
Thank you for having me.
That was Leslie Berlin talking about her excellent new book, Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age. For links to this and all of our sourcing and interviews, check out the story that goes with this week's show. It lives at KGORadio.com. Coming up after the break, we scan the past 400 years of American economic history with the most American of authors, a successful immigrant. That's teed up next. I'm Jason Middleton. This is Techonomics. Please come on back.